My question's around a perhaps lesser complex issue. You mentioned earlier this evening about international differential fee for foreign students. I came to Canada in 1999, and over the course of a five-year degree, probably paid between $20,000 and $30,000 simply in international differential fee. So
you actually paid more, right, with the base fee plus your differential fee?
Yes, yeah. Yes. The $20,000 to $30,000 is what I paid over and above what my Canadian classmates would have paid. Mm-hmm. So my question to you is, in your opinion, why does international differential fee exist? Second question would be, what is your take on its existence or lack of existence? And how should we get there?
Okay, three questions. So first of all, I brushed over this in my presentation, but first of all, the fact that it exists, I think, is all a part of a larger imperialistic sort of policy in which you continue to treat immigrants as the other, as different from those who are born here. So like Professor McLaughlin said, she is a white Canadian, but she wouldn't even qualify under the point system, but she would never have to pay international fees, or she wouldn't have to go through this this entire two-tiered system because she is classified as Canadian. Whereas immigrants, even those who are qualified, are we've mentioned several times, are driving cabs, are not being able to access education. And I think the reason an international fee exists is A, because it's profitable. You make money off the backs of working class migrant communities. It is profitable for universities. It is profitable for the Canadian state. It is because it's not like we don't have the money to support students who want to come to school. In fact, I think tuition should be dropped altogether, Europe style. But I definitely think so. November 5th, you guys should come out. Thousands are going to come out demonstrating to support. I'm sure Oprah can tell you all about it. I'm positive they're part of that movement. But I think tuition should be dropped altogether because education is a human right. I think by charging three times higher the fee to international students, you are A, making profit off the backs of immigrant communities, as has been done in so many other ways, and B, you are barring immigrant families from being able to access education. If you're non-status, you can't even access OSAP, right? So on top of the fact that your fee is three times higher, you have to pay it yourself. And then more than 95% of families in the Global South cannot afford international fees, right? So I think the idea is, let's recruit people from the privileged families, let's recruit the people from other countries who are like us, more so than anything else, and let's continue to make profit off them because they're outsiders and we can. And I think that's what that whole process is about. Do you want to add something?
Ditto. but the other question was, what can we do about it?
Yes.
Do you have any thoughts on that?
So as an activist, constantly mobilizing around the issue of tuition fees through demonstrations, to protests, to rallies. So November 5th, it's supposed to be the drop tuition day. So everybody who is in favor of dropping tuitions altogether, and like I said, that's the perfect world goal, is to drop tuitions completely. I don't actually think our demonstration might feasibly get us to drop tuition, but they are talking about tuition increase again for next year, right? Through a lot of mobilization from students, they had a tuition freeze a couple of years back, I'm sure you all remember, and then the tuition freeze was taken off, tuition went up again, it went up for international students, it went up for local students, and every year it has gone up. Then there was a freeze again a couple of years ago, and then the freeze was taken off and it went up again. And so these demonstrations send a large, a really strong message, A, to politicians who, during years where there have been demonstrations, have addressed the issue of tuition on their platforms, right? I don't think they've done it strategically or in any meaningful way, but they have given out more scholarships or more bursaries or bigger grants or loans. I think it's a problem to give out bigger loans because of interest rates, so I think that enhances the cycle of debt, but again, that's a whole separate issue. But I think there has been that type, because of mobilization, there were tuition freezes. Because of mobilization, there have been years where tuition increases did not happen. They weren't lowered or dropped, but they were not increased. And I think that's one way to continue to do the battle. No one as illegal is currently fighting for policy change at York and UFT. For A, allowing all students to access education regardless of status. And we have shamed the president of UFT and York University through a demonstration of hundreds of students into coming out and making the statement that we agree all students should have access to education. For the last hundreds of years at UFT, this wasn't even addressed, the issue of non-status students accessing education. And when a student, Saad Alam, came to know as an illegal and said, I'm being deported, he had been paying international student fees for 3 years. He had worked 3 jobs, all underpaid because he was non-status, all below minimum wage, to be able to pay his tuition. And a year before he's about to graduate, they're sending him back to Bangladesh. He has been in Canada since he was 7 years old. He's 23. He's never been to Bangladesh. He can't even speak the language. They don't have family there. His parents don't have jobs there. And they were being deported to there, right? So we mobilized around this case. And like I said, rights are never given. They're taken, right? You have to, you don't just ask for them. You demand that this is an issue that be concentrated on. Because if it was going to be given, then for years ago, it might have been addressed, right? And the president of UFT actually came out and made a statement after our demonstration. And he wrote a letter of support for Saad and sent it to Minister Finley that he believes Saad should be able to finish his education and then go back. I don't applaud the letter because the letter was actually worded in such a way that it said Saad should be able to finish his education and then go back to Bangladesh immediately after he finishes school. So clearly he's not really analyzing the larger immigration issues, but he did say students should be able to at least finish their education, right? So we're now pushing for meetings with David Naylor, with the president of York, to actually implement a policy, right? But it's going to be a long battle.
Just one more clarification. In my understanding, and I've been told this by a lot of people outside of universities as well as university staff, that the tuition fees for Canadian students, or let's just say on a broader term, the functioning of a university is funded by Canadian taxpayers in some way, shape, or form.
Mm-hmm.
And it is my understanding, and I've been told this by other people as well, that the international differential fee exists because the tuition fees for international students, of course, is not subsidized by the Canadian taxpayer. So do you agree or do you disagree with that statement?
So is the theory basically that taxpayers don't, like they do pay for student, like they subsidize education for Canadian students?
For Canadian students, yeah. And that's the reason why international differential fee exists, because if I'm coming in as a student,
mm-hmm.
My family or I have not contributed taxes to the Canadian government, hence I should pay international differential fee.
Well, already right there, that's an inaccurate fact, right? So immigrants do pay taxes. So for example, when you go to the grocery shopping or you go buy clothes in the mall, you're paying pre-calculated taxes for goods, right? Everything you buy has a tax in it, first of all. Every shirt you buy, every pair of pants you buy, every loaf of bread you buy has a pre-calculated tax. So immigrant families do contribute in that way. Also, they outright pay GST, PST, property tax, gas tax. Many of them pay income tax. Many of them pay into employment insurance, right? Many of them pay into pension funds, right? So I think I can't agree with that theory in the sense that I also don't agree that taxpayers' money is subsidizing Canadian students' education, because then why am I paying $6,000 a year from my own pocket money, right? So, and if Canadian tax dollars were paying for education or subsidizing it in any meaningful way, why would the majority of students be in this cycle of debt? Why would they all be on OSAP, right? Why are they paying back $40,000 for 40 years after graduation, right? I mean, who's it subsidized by? It's paid for by OSAP, if that's what you mean by subsidy, but I think that's not a meaningful subsidy. It's not a grant, it's a loan, and it's a loan that needs to be paid back at triple the rate by the time you can pay it back. So I don't agree with that theory, but if someone else might want to speak to that, I don't know.
Yeah, I've heard the same theory. I was an international student for my master's degree. I went to England, and it was the same thing. I had to pay triple the fees. So I think a lot of countries do this in order to get as much money as they can out of immigrants or out of foreign students. Again, it's in the financial interest of the country, but I think it would be great to have students rallying solidarity, because the truth is, our classrooms, especially at the University of Guelph, they're very homogeneous, very Canadian, very white, and that is a detriment to all of us, because our lives are expanded through interaction with people from other parts of the world. So it's in everyone's interest to advocate for foreign students to be able to access education, and And that would be a good rallying cry on November 5th to not only decrease tuition for Canadian students, but to also really target the discrimination against foreign students and the amount that they pay.
And that is one of Nona's illegals' demands, that international drop so that all students, if they are residents in Canada, pay local tuition fees, at the very least.
Right. I just have a final comment, and this is from, you know, in my years when I was an undergrad student, which is not that long ago. The tuition fees, I went to a university in the Atlantic provinces. The tuition fees for Canadian students increased by 10% for, you know, roughly about 3 years, three consecutive years. In those same 3 years, the international differential fee increased 25%. Mm-hmm. That in no way was fair. Of course, there was not much representation because the ratios of international students are much lower. And these are students that do not have any family, perhaps, in Canada. They may be quite young people who don't understand the dynamics of all this. So just a comment for people, you know, who are here, who are lucky enough not to have to pay international differential fee, that it is very discriminatory. And an increase of 25% when you increase tuition fees for the rest of the population by 10% speaks to that. Mm-hmm. I'd like to thank you for answering those questions.
Yeah,
thank you.
And I don't want to sound like a conspiracy theorist, but I think that also what it works to do is bar immigrant families here from, you know, being able to access a system in which they can upgrade themselves and be able to compete in the workforce fairly, right? So that's how you not only attract an exploitable pool of cheap labor, but you keep them exploitable and cheap, right? That's one of the ways, or at least that's one of the repercussions, intentional or not, right?
This is a question regarding the farm workers program, the seasonal. I'm wondering if you've spoken about a shortage of labor in Ontario and that these migrant workers are filling that shortage of labor. And it's working on the assumption, and correct me if you don't agree with this assumption, working on the assumption that there's a shortage of labor from Ontario residents for agriculture because it's low paying and extremely hard work. Do you believe that Ontarians should work to up the wages for agriculture workers and try to promote Ontario people to take those jobs, or continue with the migrant worker system and improve the rights of those migrant workers?
That's a really challenging question and a very important one. There's no easy answer to that. I think when looking at farming in particular, it's important to place the conditions on farms in Canada in a global context, because farm work all around the world is cheap, hard, difficult, and exploitable labor. And so what Canadian farmers have argued, and to an extent I can understand their point, is that if they didn't have an easily exploitable workforce, they couldn't compete as farmers, because every other country in the world has an easily exploitable low-paid workforce. And even with the amount that they're having to pay for migrant workers, a lot of them are still going under, a lot of them still can't make ends meet, especially smaller family farms. Although, of course, there are large agribusiness that are quite profitable. So it does get a bit tricky when thinking, how do we work at this issue? And I do believe, of course, that people should receive higher wages and better conditions, and for all workers, Canadian and foreign. But the reality of globalized agriculture is that I think we need to rethink protecting our local food systems and not just allowing cheap imports from China to flood our market and then put farmers in a position where they're really, like, a lot of them are really struggling. Some of them commit suicide because they're just going under. So agriculture is a really unique industry in that respect, and it's important to understand the global dynamics facing all small farmers here as well as elsewhere. But that's no excuse to not treat workers with dignity, respect, decent conditions, and decent wages. And I think that government policy needs to enforce those conditions, whether they're immigrant workers or Canadian workers. And for me, the most important thing is that these migrant workers, if they do come, if Canadians really aren't willing to do this work, is that there's an end in sight, that they can come here and eventually become permanent residents, that they're not just bound to continually be going back and forth, separated from their families for decades, disposable the minute something goes wrong. That's really unacceptable, and that is the underlying injustice of the program, in my opinion. Yeah, and the fundamental wage system is really unjust because workers are deducted so much money for pension, employment insurance, taxes, and what Alan was just referring to is that all Caribbean workers, 25% of their wages are withheld and sent to Jamaica. And they can only claim this money if and when they return home. And even then, they don't get all of it back. Part of that money goes to pay for the liaison service and the program. So when you're paying them just above minimum wage, and they have all of these deductions, and then they can't actually benefit from those deductions, and they're making so little to begin with, really they are going home often with very little in their pockets, and still it's more than they would earn at home, but that doesn't justify this treatment. And really we have to look at it again as a Canadian state policy to be making all of these with deductions from this pay and then to not give them the benefits when something goes wrong. It's really problematic.
I have one more question, if I may. Thank you for your answers. Perhaps you could give me an update on the Occupational Health and Safety Act. Occupational Health and Safety Act. And what's happening with it, because if I'm correct, I believe it doesn't apply to the agricultural sector right now.
Okay, so you're right. For decades, all farm workers were excluded from the Occupational Health and Safety Act. But several years ago, the United Food and Commercial Workers Union launched a challenge saying that was unjust, that they are excluded. And so in 2006, this is at the provincial level. The McGuinty government implemented this act to be now eligible for migrant farm workers, or for all farm workers rather. But it's been really limited in its effect because most migrant farm workers don't know anything about this act. They don't know that they're covered. It's a complaint-driven system, so they wouldn't know who to complain to. Some of them don't speak the language, even if they did. But most fundamentally, there's no protection for workers who complain for being fired and sent home. So they're too afraid to complain, even if they knew all their rights and knew how to access them. Mm-hmm. The minute they make a complaint, the employer can fire them and send them home the next day. So until that fundamental injustice is removed from this program, all of these rights and all of these laws are meaningless, essentially, because workers are too afraid to access them. So it is good that they've implemented the act, but its effects have been minimal, I would say.
Thank you.
My question is very much related. I'm wondering who accepts responsibility when workers are injured? I guess it's a naive expectation, but an employer caused your illness. They sprayed pesticides on you. It's the worker compensation. I'm just curious what the difference between worker compensation for people with or without, who gets the rights to workers' compensation for things that are clearly the fault of the employer?
That's a great question, and if you're interested, I just wrote a paper on this, so I can send it to you. It goes into it in more depth, but just very briefly, workers are covered for workers' compensation, but there are a number of major barriers to them accessing compensation. In this case, in the case of the workers with kidney failure, and there are several of them actually who have kidney failure, the problem is that there can't be a clear link between the pesticide exposure and the ultimate outcome proven. And that's what the Workers' Compensation Board requires in order to provide benefits. So in all of these cases, actually, no claim was ever even filed. And I think that is a mistake. At least a claim should have been filed and an investigation should have been made. But it wasn't. And so at this point, you can't test his blood for pesticide levels. It happened over a year ago. And without that proof, they won't give you any compensation. So really, no one's held responsible for this. And that is another flaw in the program. And many Canadian workers also have difficulty accessing workers' compensation. It's a complicated system, and it's also flawed. So ultimately, they should be paying compensation, but often, for many reasons, they don't receive that compensation. Like with cancer and kidney failure, these are really complex medical conditions that have a variety of possible contributing factors. So genetics, environment, exposures, many factors that are still unclear. So it's very hard to make these clear links. Only in cases, for example, of asbestos-caused rare lung illnesses, then they're able to say, yes, everyone here associated with asbestos got the same rare lung cancer, so we'll provide them compensation. But for cancers and kidney failures, it's really difficult for any worker to get compensated because it's so complex. And the other issue with workers' comp is that employers have to pay into it, and their fees go up if there are claims made. So there's a real incentive for them to not bring the workers to the doctor, to not file for claims, and to actively discourage them not to make reports. And that's because they will have to pay more money. A claim like this would cost a lot of money because this is a permanent impairment, potentially leading to death. So the employer in this case would certainly have an incentive to not want this worker to apply for workers' compensation.
Yep.
So I was just wondering, for the live-in caregiver program, if they are fired and they have no access to any welfare or anything, like, where do they go after, like, they have to leave the home they were in?
So this is just one of the many amazing contradictions within the system. So I mentioned the SDR factory raid in Mississauga. Factory was raided and 45 non-status undocumented workers were arrested. Out of those 45, more than 24 of them were part of the live-in caregiver program. So your visa stipulates you cannot work anywhere other than within your employer's home as a live-in caregiver. These women were all fired because, everyone has their own situation, but for many of them it was because they were abused. Some of them were raped. One woman got here as part of the program, but her employer was making her have sex with clients he was inviting into the home. She quit. She had to find a new home. So why? And I'm sure some of them quit. I'm sure there's a myriad of reasons I'm not covering. But when you quit, you are not allowed to work anywhere else, and you cannot access, like I said, subsidized housing, welfare. If you don't have status, you can't even go to a food bank some of the time, right? And that's about implementing the don't ask, don't tell policy in all these spaces. But until we get there, those workers were arrested and sent to detention centers because they were basically trying to survive and make a living. Because you have 3 months to find a new job, but who's feeding you in that 3 months? Who's paying your rent in that 3 months, right? So a lot of these women work under the table to make a living and to survive until they can find a new job. And the repercussions were that they were detained, right? And I think that's really all part of that exploitable pool of labor. Who else is going to work for $5 an hour, 16 hours a day, right? Except someone who lives in that type of fear.
Yeah, I was just wondering where they live after,
So a lot of housing won't allow you to live if you don't have status, but basically it's very under the table. You find a place with other people in your situation who are non-status. You find a immigrant-friendly neighborhood if you can. You go underground, you go into hiding, and you live in fear every day that if you're caught, you'll be detained or deported. That's the reality.
Or you live with a friend, he said. And that actually, the other seasonal agriculture workers in similar situations with Alan who have not been able to go home because they're sick and they need treatment, Canadian families have taken them in each case and are providing a place for them to live and providing them with the support that they need. But, it's hard to find that. It's not a solution that the government is providing. It's just people out of the goodness of their hearts taking these people in for unspecified periods of time. So, well, thank you for those very insightful questions. I think the organizers are busy chatting, so I think we're out of questions, guys. If you want to draw a close to the night, I don't know if there's anything else you want to say, but I'm really grateful for the opportunity for all of us to be here. And
yeah, thanks everybody.
And thanks for sticking it out to the bitter end. Thank you.